Today on Focal Point, Pastor Mike Fabares asks if your priorities are in order.
If life was a football game, when you graduate from high school, you're done with the first quarter. When you're 37, the marching band is on the field, right? Because you and I are under the sentence of God not to last very long. And when it comes to this life, do you see how even letting the first six verses of Psalm 90 resonate starts to help me reprioritize my life?
Sad songs say so much. In fact, many of the psalms in Scripture were soulful, heart-wrenching laments, written from the depths of despair. They express raw, unfiltered grief before moving to a place of hope. Are you blue today? Maybe you've lost someone close to you, or you're saying goodbye to another chapter in life. As we begin, Pastor Mike Fabares gives us the sobering backstory of Psalm 90. It's a framework for rediscovering meaning and purpose in light of the brevity of life.
Well, as with the music on your iPod, the songs in God's inspired playlist are not all happy ones. They're not all happy ones. Well, sure, there are in the book of Psalms plenty of jubilant, celebratory psalms, but if you've read through all 150, it's easy to see that the Psalter is filled with an ample supply of sad songs, very sad songs, actually some of them. But like you and your iPod, I think it's clear that God knows that sometimes it's the lyrics of the songs that spring from broken hearts and bad situations that sometimes do the most to minister to us. Often it's those kinds of songs that can end up reprioritizing and changing and redirecting our lives like none other. So in that regard, the end result of what these sad songs in the Psalter try to accomplish when we come across them is really for our good and ultimately for our happiness and joy, as we'll see in the psalm today. If you haven't already turned there, please take your Bibles and turn to Psalm 90, which is not only a sad song, perhaps one of the saddest, it's also one of the oldest. It actually is the oldest. It is, as you'll see there, if you found that psalm, the superscription says a prayer of Moses, the man of God, Moses. Now, David, if you remember a little of the biblical chronology, is some 450 years after Moses. And David, of course, is usually associated with the psalms because so many of the psalms are credited to David. So we've got this very old song that was written by the author that God used to write Genesis through Deuteronomy. So we've got something that fits all the way back in that time frame in the Old Testament. It's a prayer of Moses, or a heartfelt prayer that comes in a bad situation. Just glance through it and you can see these are not happy times. These are difficult times. And whenever you find this phrase, drop down to verse 13 real quick, even before we read it, just point out that second little line there that says in verse 13, how long? Whenever you see that in the Psalms, it's good to ask, what's going on here contextually and historically? And if we read about Moses' life there, in the book of Exodus in particular, I mean, that's where the story of his life is told, two candidates come quickly to mind historically. I mean, you think of the one where he's crying out, how long, when it comes to the enslavement of the Israelites to the Egyptian taskmasters, and he's crying out to God, and he desperately wants to see them delivered. Matter of fact, if you glance up to verse number 10, he uses the phrase in the second line there, toil and trouble, the span of life being filled with toil and trouble. And you certainly think of that when you see the taskmasters, tightening the clutch of their grip on the Israelites building their edifices in Egypt. But I don't believe that's the context, though some would suggest it. If you glance through the first six verses, you'll see a focus on death. I mean, talk about a dirge. This is This is the focus here, definitely. In the first six verses, I mean, here we talk about the brevity of life and the problem of our lives being so short and even being cut short. And, you know, we rise up in the morning and flourish in the day and get cut down at the night. I mean, this death theme then probably takes us to the other candidate, which is definitely the, I believe, the right historical context to put this psalm. And that is when they went out into the desert for 40 years. Now, I don't want to, you know, be redundant. Hopefully you know this story, but they go to Kadesh Barnea there when they are taken out of Egypt through the Red Sea. They're brought to the front door of the promised land that was promised to Abraham, you know, hundreds of years before Moses. And he says, go get them. They send out their 12 spies. 10 of them come back, frightened that the cities are too fortified, the armed people are too big. And so God gets mad and says, fine then, I'm done with this generation. You guys can wander around the desert for 40 years. Now that's another season of life where you can see Moses crying out, how long is this going to last? I mean, this is tough. This is hard. And death as a theme fits perfectly because if you've ever really thought about some of the details of the Old Testament story, you've got to understand how ubiquitous and how overpowering this concept of death must have been during this time. Not to bore you, but a little backdrop to this. In Genesis chapter 50, we see the end of the story of Joseph. Joseph dies. The date is 1800 BC. We don't pick up the next book, Exodus chapter 1, until the birth of Moses. And when that starts to get told, now we are in 1525, right? We've had 275 years elapse from the end of Genesis to the beginning of Exodus. Well, what was going on there? Well, we call them silent years, but we know what was going on because one of the facts we learn at the end of Genesis is there are only 75 people in the clans of Israel. That's it. We had the patriarchs, we had the kids, we had the grandkids. We had 75 people we called Israelites. By the time we pick it up in Exodus, we have 2.5 million. So we don't need a book between Genesis and Exodus. We know exactly what they were doing for 275 years, right? I mean, they're having kids, lots of them. Now we've got a huge, right, voluminous nation, and they're in trouble. And so all the story plays out, and they end up going now into the desert as a discipline of the Lord, and God says this, you're going to wander for 40 years, and everybody 20 years old and older, with the exception of two guys, Sunday school graduates, who were those two guys? Very good. Joshua and Caleb, they were the only two exceptions over 20, they were all going to die in the wilderness. Now think that through, just conservative estimates. Right? Let's just say there's, 1.2 million people that are over 20 years old. Okay? You've got to now kill them off in 40 years. Right? They're going to die in a 40-year, four decades, 1.2 million people are going to die. No matter how many are born, that's how many funerals you've got. That's over 30,000 funerals a year. That's over 2,500 a month. That's over 83 a day. Now you're saying, well, that's a big community of people. I get that. Fine, let's put it in perspective. Let's assume that Compass Bible Church, the size of our church, is one little sub-clan of a tribe in Israel. So take the number of people, I did the math on this, people over 20 in our church, and you say, okay, well, here's a normal group of people, and we're living our lives normally here, and you think about the death rate among us. Right, if you take our church and you ask the question, here's the easy way to ask it, how many funerals do we have in this church, you know, in any given span of time? And the answer would be roughly, rough and dirty, any given year, we probably have, I don't know, in our church family, one a month. Now, I don't know if you want to take that stat and compare it to the next church you're planning to go to just to see what the death rate is in their church, but I mean, that's your odds of dying in our church. So, now think this through. You take the same strata of people and you put them in our church, same demographic, and we happen to be living under the sentence of Kadesh Barnea, which is you're all going to die in the next 40 years if you're over 20, right? You're going to have 10 a month in a family our size, okay? 10 a month. If we had a funeral every 3 days, do you think death would be on our mind? Can you imagine that? I mean, death is pervasive in this period of time. With that in mind, and with my suggestion, having studied this, and as your pastor saying, I think this is the historical context, let's read these 17 verses and see if we can put ourselves in the sandals of Moses here and think through this prayer of Moses, the man of God. Verse 1, follow along as I read it for you. Lord, you've been our dwelling place in all generations. Now, like a lot of the Psalms we've read, we kind of start with the conclusion. We get this sense of God, and he's a refuge, he's a rock. We go to him in times of trouble. Great. Now we talk about his eternality. Verse 2, before the mountains were brought forth, or ever you had formed the earth and the world from everlasting to everlasting, you are God. But, by contrast, verse 3, you return man to dust, and you say, quote, return, O children of man, unquote. Well, for 1,000 years in your sight, they're better as yesterday when it's past, or a watch in the night. You sweep them away as with a flood, right? They're like a dream, like grass that is renewed in the morning. In the morning it flourishes, and it's renewed. In the evening it fades and it withers. Now note here the driving force behind this. This makes us think of the wilderness wanderings. For we are brought to an end by your anger. By your wrath we are dismayed. For you've set our iniquities before you, our secret sins in the light of your presence. For all of our days pass away under your wrath. We bring our years to an end like a sigh. The years of our life, they're 70, or even by reason of strength, 80 perhaps, right? Yet their span is but toil and trouble. They're soon gone and we fly away. Who considers the power of your anger and your wrath according to the fear of you? Also teach us to number our days that we may get a heart of wisdom. Return, O Lord, how long? Have pity on your servants. Satisfy us in the morning with your hesed, your loyal, your steadfast love, that we may rejoice and be glad all of our days. Make us glad for as many days as you've afflicted us, and for as many years as we've seen evil. Let your work be shown to your servants and your glorious power to their children. Let the favor of the Lord our God be upon us, and establish the work of our hands upon us. Yes, establish the work of our hands. Can you see that against that historical backdrop? Now, we got in the meat of this, verses 7 through 12, talking a lot about God's frustration and anger. But if you note again, just glancing through verses 1 through 6, we don't have any discussion of his anger or wrath. I mean, that's what the reason is historically here, if I'm right about the context. But all we really get is the sense of the, you know, mortality, the finite nature of mankind. And that is a recurring biblical theme. We see it everywhere. Not to divorce it from its context, but let's just spend some time in the first six verses thinking about the idea of living a life that seems really short compared to the eternality of God. That we are like, really, from God's perspective, grass that flourishes in the daytime, but by the evening, it's gone. I mean, that's a biblical motif stated even with that illustration many times over and over in the Bible, and that should get us to thinking. What does God want us to learn from that? Even before we get to the historical context, let's let that one resonate, as unpleasant as it is. And what we'll find is when we see it contrasted with verse 1 and verse 2, with the greatness, the unmovability, that sense of the eternality of God, and we compare our own fleeting lives to that, we start to get real small. I mean, we talk about a high view of God in our church, and that's a kind of a spatial analogy. And so it is to say we have a big God, or to get a bigger view of God. And the bigger your view of God, or the higher your view of God, you're going to have a smaller view of yourself by comparison. Even the Greek word in the New Testament, we teach often about the word humility is a word kind of that has that sense of smallness, to think smallly. It's to have that diminutive sense of myself as next to God. And so I think it'd be good, before we even get into the history of this text, to think a little bit about those first six verses and just in terms of our need to be humbled by it. Jot this down. Number one on your worksheet, we need to be humbled by the brevity of life. You are not here very long. And in light of God, and I think we need to recognize even the atheist has a sense of what God is doing to create kind of that paradox within our own heart, that chafing in our own heart against death itself. We need to recognize that remembering the brevity of life is helpful, as unpleasant as it is. This is not the only time in the Psalms we see the call to number our days. And without the historical backdrop of Moses in the wilderness, let me turn you over to Psalm 39 real quick. Keep your finger here in Psalm 90. We'll be right back. But look at Psalm 39, which is a psalm of David. 400 years later, he writes this psalm, and he talks about this same idea of saying, now, I just need to remember I'm not here very long. And as you think about this, we'll just read a few verses here. I want you to remember that this is a perspective. Though it wants us to focus on it, it never wants us to accept it. If you look at the whole of Scripture as something good, right, obviously, or something even normal, or even something natural, which, by the way, just to take a little sidebar here, commentary on our culture, that's what they're telling us all the time, isn't it? I mean, it's not odd to go to a funeral, have the guy get up pontificating about death and saying, well, you know, it's a part of life. You'll hear it in the eulogies. You'll hear people talk that way. Listen, the next time someone says to you that death is just a part of life, I want you to stop and really think about those words. Duh. Really? No. There's nothing could be more antithetical to life than death, right? Nothing is worse for life than death. It stops life. There's nothing natural about that. Just because it happens all the time, And it certainly isn't something we need to embrace as good. You hear that sometimes when an old person dies, and at an old person's funeral, you hear them say, well, she lived a good life. And you kind of get the flip of the hand there. I lived a long life. Like, she's had her time on the planet, you know, get her off, we'll get on, you know, give us some space here, right? No. And you're saying, well, wait a minute, Mike, I know you're saying that, but you know, there have been times I've watched my ailing relative and I love them and I really have been kind of welcoming death. I get that. The only time, though, you want to replace life with death is when you see the one living in such excruciating pain, you think it'd be better to get the relief of death. But you take that out of the equation, right? You're sitting, I don't care if she's 90, you're sitting next to the spry, happy 90-year-old gal serving you cookies, wanting to talk about how your day was. You don't say, hey, you're 90, man, you've lived a good long life, enough with you, right? You'd never think that. That's evil. That's wrong. Death is not a part of life. It's the enemy of life. That's how the Bible presents it. I mean, it's not natural. If you read Genesis, it's the most unnatural thing ever. It was a sentence of God upon mankind. It was not there initially as the design for us. And just to quote before we even look at Psalm 39, one little line out of Ecclesiastes. David's son, the opulent King Solomon, wrote this. This is 3:11 if you're a note taker. Ecclesiastes 3:11, you look at the context later, it's a lot like Psalm 37, but he says this, God has set eternity in our hearts. Do you remember that? God has set eternity. That's why we chafe against it. It's not just teenagers who think they're going to live forever. We like to push the idea of death out because really it is an unnatural thought. We don't really naturally gravitate to our own finite brevity. We don't think about our lives that way. We like to think it's going to continue on. Your body may be feeling like it's getting old, but tell me, really, do you feel like, oh, you know, I've been here long enough? No, only when you ache and you hurt and when you're in pain. The reality is we chafe against it because God has set something in our hearts to connect with the infinite, the God who is from everlasting to everlasting. And we don't like to even think about our own demise because it doesn't really feel right. And that's okay. It shouldn't. And yet, as Psalm 39 says, you ought to remember that you're not here forever. That's helpful. Take a look at these verses. Just real quick. Couple verses out of Psalm 39. Look at verse 4. Here's David. He says, O Lord, make me know my end. Right? And what is the measure of my days? Now, he's not asking for September 12th, 2016 or whatever. You're not trying to give us the date. The idea is the next line, let me know how fleeting I am. Let me remember I'm not infinite. Though in my heart you've placed eternity in my heart, remind me that I'm not here on the planet very long. Right? Let me know how fleeting my life is. Behold, verse 5, you have made me and my days, what, a few handbreadths. If you read the Bible very long, you hear about the cubic all the time. That was kind of the standard, you know, measuring stick. But if you wanted a little measurement, you'd use a handbreadth. My life's just a few handbreadths, just a small little... just a little blip on the timeline. My lifetime, if I think about you, is as nothing before you. And yet my heart naturally connects with the infinite. I naturally think about God who's forever. I don't think about being done with this life, but I need to remember that I will be. Surely all mankind stands as a mere breath. You can start to hear some themes that we hear recurring in James, if you've read James, right? Surely man goes about as a shadow, verse 6. Surely they're nothing, right? Nothing they are in turmoil. Man heaps up wealth, doesn't know who's going to gather it. It comes and it goes. Now that sense of brevity should humble us. Though in our hearts we want to feel eternal, we need to recognize our life on earth is very short. And since David here says, number your days, and Moses says later in our text in Psalm 90 to number your days, let's just put our days in numbers, right? The average lifespan in America, certainly in a group this size, this demographic, would be 75 years, 2 months. I mean, depending on when you were born, what year you were born, and of course your genetics and all that. But that's the rough and dirty American, you know, life expectancy. You want to put that into days, that's just under 28,000 days. And that sounds like a lot. Well, that's a lot to spend. Well, think this through, if you can remember back to when you graduated from high school. By the time you walked the aisle in high school, you had already spent 17,000 of them. Done. 17,000 days. 17,400 by the time you're 18. Done. Okay? Now, let's just put it this way. Maybe it'd be helpful. If life was a football game, when you graduate from high school, you're done with the first quarter. Now, when you tune into a football game after the first quarter is over, you think you've missed a good chunk of it. And high school graduates, quarter of it's done. When you're 37, the marching band is on the field, right? The baton twirler's doing her thing out there. 37. That redefines midlife, doesn't it? I mean, you thought midlife was a lot later. 37. That's the statistical midlife of the average American today. 56 years old. You're moving into the fourth quarter. Is that painful? I just love this, Pastor. So encouraging. You know, it's helpful though, isn't it? Because when you're about to make that transition from the third to the fourth quarter, you're thinking, man, if I'm going to get something done in this football game, I'd better do it, right? It's the fourth quarter. Shall I even go on? I mean, if you're in your 70s or anywhere near that, you should be hearing the two-minute warning, basically, in the back. I don't mean to be insulting, but what I'm saying is that we don't have as much time as we may think because you and I are under the sentence of God not to last very long. And when it comes to this life, do you see how even letting the first six verses of Psalm 90 resonate starts to help me reprioritize my life? And I have no time for these passages, but let me throw them out real quick if you're a copious note taker. How about this one? Luke 12, Jesus tells a parable about a guy with a big field and it's doing really well. He builds big silos so he can stock it all up and hoard it. You remember that? And then God says something you won't see him say anywhere else in the Bible. He throws out two pejorative words. You fool, he says to the guy. You fool. Why is he a fool? Because here's what he said. I stocked all this up. Here's the line right before he calls him a fool. He says, relax, right? Eat, drink, and be merry. I have many things stored up for me for many years to come. Now it's time to chill out. God says, you fool, for you did not know that tonight your soul is required of you. Right? And here's this juxtaposition of a guy who seems very prepared to live out the end of his life. And God says, you don't have that. You should have been living life now. You should have been doing what you should be doing now. You shouldn't be trying to stock it up so you can chill out later. Because here's the thing, not that God is against financial planning, but he says, so is the man. Here's the parable of the story. So is the man who is not rich toward God, right? His priorities take a back seat. That's what takes me and your little assignment to Matthew 6, because that's the whole point there. He says, listen, you guys are so busy storing up treasure on earth, you're very short-sighted, he says, as human beings, right? But the problem is on earth, all of your attainments here, moth can eat them up, rust can corrode them, thieves can break in and steal them. Why don't you start trying to be rich toward God? He puts it this way, store up treasure in heaven. Nothing can get to that there. And here's how he summarizes it in verse 33 of Matthew 6. He says, therefore, seek first the kingdom and his righteousness, right? And then all these other things you're worried about, they'll be added to you. Don't worry about that. You worry about putting my priorities first. The brevity of life can help us readjust our priorities.
Putting first things first. You're listening to Pastor Mike Fabares presenting his message, The Brevity of Life, here on Focal Point. To download helpful study notes or free audio files, go to focalpointradio.org. Well, today Pastor Mike reminded us that our grief won't last forever. Maybe you've lost a job, a relationship, or felt the sting of death. You've experienced what it means to yearn for the everlasting. Losses can leave us in a place of depression and despair unless we learn to think rightly and land squarely where God intends us. And that's what focusing on the Psalms can train us to do. Now, there's a devotional that Pastor Mike wrote to help us in this important process. It's called Change My Heart, O God, and it includes 52 scriptural reflections, each concluding with a practical resolve or next step you can take to put into practice what God's taught you. When you're feeling weighed down and lost, this journal provides ample room to vent. Then, vet your thinking against God's Word and allow it to transform you, leading you to the healthy next step. You can get your own keepsake quality copy of Change My Heart, O God, when you send in a generous financial gift this month. Call 888-320-5885 or go to focalpointradio.org. Life's tough, but God's Word provides all we need to survive. That's why Focal Point partners are on the front lines every month, giving a set donation to ensure these daily visits continue here on your station, on the internet, and through our podcast and mobile apps free. Listeners all across the country are depending on the solid expository teaching they receive every day from Pastor Mike. Become a Focal Point partner today, and you'll help them reach, teach, and train others with accurate and relevant Bible teaching. Call 888-320-5885. Or go to focalpointradio.org. I'm Dave Drewy, inviting you back again tomorrow when Pastor Mike Fabares returns with more from the Psalms, Wednesday on Focal Point. Today's program was produced and sponsored by Focal Point Ministries.